Hey folks, you can now hear How Did I Get Here while on the go with Stitcher Smart Radio. On-demand news, talk, and more for your mobile phone. The latest episode is always available for you. No syncing needed, and no memory or storage wasted. Available for your iPhone, Android phone, webOS phones, all your pads, iPads, notepads. Downloading is easy. Go to Stitcher.com or check out your app store. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio.
And you may ask yourself, well, how did I get here?
It's time for How Did I Get Here? And now here is your host.
Well, hello everyone. I'm Johnny, I'm your host. I am coming to you from a few days ago, if you're listening to this the day it comes out, because I'm in Miami visiting family. I talked about it on the last podcast. I have a bit of apprehension, a little nervous about it. For me, right now, it's New Year's Day. I played last night in Houston with Skyrocket. It was a fantastic show. It was sold out. People were there. They were loving it. We had a great time. We got to play Prince 1999 after Auld Lang Syne at midnight, and it was great. And of course, we played American Girl, and everyone was very happy. It was a great New Year for everybody involved, and I woke up this morning and drove home so that I could talk to you lovely people. That's what I did. So right now, as you're listening to this, if you're listening to it the day it comes out or maybe the day after, I'm in Miami. I'm with family. It might be a little weird, or it might be amazingly awesome, or I might be at a pool, or I might be at the beach. So a lot of stuff could be happening. I've got some friends there I'm going to try and reconnect with, some cousins. I'm trying to reach out now. I'm going on Facebook. I'm using different things. I'm about to send up some smoke signals to see if anyone's out there. And what about you? How's your New Year's coming? Did you make some resolutions? Like, did you join a gym? And then, did you go? Or have you already given up? Or have you already messed up a resolution? Like, I'm not going to drink so much, or you got wasted on New Year's Day or something. Now, I already messed up. Because last night on New Year's Eve, even on stage, we talked resolution talk to the audience. And I shared mine. I want to eat better. I want to do that by not eating so much fast food. Because, you know, I'm single. It's easy to do. It's all around my street. And it's easy, you know, you just pick it up and you eat it. And so my resolution, I already broke it this morning on the way back from Houston. I was driving, and for about 45 miles or so, I argued with myself in between like three or four McDonald's. It's like, man, it's almost, you know, 10. There's not going to be breakfast in 30 minutes. And then there I went, Egg McMuffin style, hash browns, fast food. So can you start a New Year's resolution on the 2nd?
How did I get here, lying in the sunshine?
You might know my guest today from a lot of different things. He's been an integral part of the Austin music scene for a long time, playing. He's got a band called the Texas Tycoons that plays a tribute to Texas music. He had a band called Super Ego. He also was the architect of the rock and roll free-for-all at the Hole in the Wall that went on for, 7-8 years. It was really great. A lot of cool things happened there. And right down to, you might know him from his company, Minor Productions. They have sound systems in most of the clubs here in town, a lot of the clubs, Hotel Vegas, Hole in the Wall. And, this is him. His name's Paul Minor. He's a great guy. You probably know him if you're from Austin here, if you've come through Austin and been a part of any kind of the scene here. And you'll be happy to hear his story. It's a great story. And the coolest thing about it was I didn't hear the song that I play at the very end until after we had done the interview. And it really tells the story of his life. So if you listen all the way through, it's basically the podcast in a 4-minute song. That's great. I love him. Band Texas Tycoons. Okay, so here's my good buddy, Paul Minor. Let's get down.
Thank you. and kindness are down on their knees. One is crippled and the other diseased. They're both begging, won't somebody please put us out of our miseries before somebody else does the choking. We're strung out and lonely and mad.
You're a Texas Music Hall of Fame member. That's good.
It's been rumored.
It has been rumored. What
it rarely comes up, but thank you.
What does a guy have to do to do that? That's a big question.
You know, I'm a longtime friend of Margaret Moser.
I thought you were going to be like, I've been in there so long. I don't even know.
I can't even remember what I did.
When were you inducted? Like 10 years ago or something?
It must have been. It was around the time the Hole in the Wall was closed for a year, maybe 2000, 2001. Ooh, and I think it's just because of just being an old friend of Margaret and having done a lot of, you know, just my music promotion work.
Well, you know what I was going to say, not just being a musician, but you also, the scene that you created there was possibly the best scene that I've been here for, to be honest with you. Those Sunday nights were there was no walls. There wasn't like, it was a place where my band could go and not be a steamboat band. You know what I'm saying? Because there were walls up, and a band wasn't an Emo's band, and a band wasn't an Electric Lounge band. It was the Sunday night at the Hole in the Wall, and everyone was hanging out.
There were cliques. There still are. But if you can do something that's eclectic and all-inclusive and mix it up.
That's what you did. Right. And that was an important thing.
Yeah, it needed to happen.
Yeah, for a lot of bands. I mean, Fastball, you know, those guys were kind of born out of that, weren't they?
I mean,
Skyrocket. I saw the KTEL Hit Machine there, and that's where I was like,
even remember that, but I believe it.
It did happen.
Yeah, I now that I think about it,
yeah,
there's a lot of magic moments like that. That's definitely one of them. I like hearing about stuff like that, and people come up to me sometimes and say, our band had our first gig there, and it was such a wonderful time.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm...
Something to be proud of.
Thank you. I feel like what's great about it was that it was completely uncontrived, unplanned. It had nothing to do with any kind of corporate marketing plan.
No.
It was some guys sitting around going, what are we going to do with this Sunday night they just gave us?
Right.
You know, we literally had a residency fall in our lap.
Right.
And me and some friends, a bartender from the Electric Lounge named John Nodal.
Uh-huh.
He had a lot to do with the concept. We were both really into things like the Gong Show and variety show format kind of things, where it's just you just kind of throw a lot of things at the wall and see what sticks.
Yeah.
So that was the rock and roll free for all, and if every interview I do for the rest of my life.
You have to talk
sort
about
of
it.
Makes a reference to that time and that time in my life. I'll always think, well, those were the good times, man.
Well, let me ask you this: we just heard a song from Shadow Man, and is that the album? I remember watching Emmy television. I can't remember exactly when it was, but there was a video of you that you obviously did yourself driving around in a truck.
That was from a CD before Shadow Figure.
Okay.
That was called
Shadow Figure. Sorry,
that's okay. It's called Low Overhead, and it was so under the radar. You know, I must have made 300 copies of that CD, and not even got anywhere near close to exhausting that inventory.
Right.
It was in the Jupiter Records days when that one came out.
Yeah,
I had a CD release at Jupiter. But Adam Bork filmed that. And,
oh, he did.
Yeah, and he and I drove around the block in my truck like three times.
Yeah.
But that was the one time where the timing was perfect, and I pulled out of the driveway and pulled back into the driveway just as the song ended. And we also saw Lawrence from the Hole in the Wall as we were driving around on that take.
Right.
And he came up to the truck and was like pointing at us and stuff, and it was just classic.
Well, it was great to see, and I was like, oh, awesome, he's making some solo albums.
Uh-huh.
So you've been doing that, and you have made how many solo albums? So you did a Super Ego album at the beginning. It was Paul Miner.
I've made two.
Okay.
I've made Shadow Figure and the Marfa Project.
And the Marfa Project, did you go there and record it? Is that
what
you did?
I did, and I recorded with Marfa musicians, David Beebe and Adam Bork, and Gory Smelly, who was the engineer. And then I did some overdubs and mixing here in town with Michael Crow. Actually, I mixed it in Marfa, too. I brought it back here, worked on it some more, and then finished it in Marfa, mixed it.
What is it? I've been there, and I like it a lot.
Yeah, it's
I've gone there for a while, for like a week, and just kind of hung around, you know, like Balmoray. I went swimming there, and I stayed in like Fort Davis a little bit.
I love Fort Davis. Yeah. Marfa is a whole nother scene. I mean, it's just like a weird, what would you call that, a parallel universe or something. It's kind of dreamlike
it's
when
like
you're there.
Rich and kind of famous people hanging out with just regular dudes like Earth Pig.
That's right. And yeah, Adam is the, he's like the kingpin now. He's got
so
new restaurants.
Though, right?
Yeah, BB's on the city council.
He is.
Yeah.
That's so awesome.
Yeah, he's working on some serious stuff out there right now about water rights, trying to unite the ranchers to make it's.
So it's not just some hip, cool art scene. He's actually delving into stuff with ranchers and working with the people.
Yeah. I mean, if you want to live in Marfa, you really have to have a purpose in life. And so it's got a lot of wide open space, and it gives you a chance to kind of like break it all down and figure out what you're doing. And then what is important to you kind of bubbles to the surface, and then people do some amazing shit.
Yeah. So do you go there a lot?
I do. I actually tried to move there this summer, and I wasn't ready.
Your purpose was not fully realized.
It's like kind of one of those, using the Force, or one of those deals where you're not quite a ninja yet.
Right.
I was not a Jedi for Marfa yet.
But ultimately, that's the goal. That's what you want to do.
I don't know. I mean, there's, I don't know. It's almost like been there, done that too.
But the guys like us, how are we supposed to live out there? I mean,
Railroad Blues, you can
only play at Railroad Blues so many times.
We may not be cut out for it. Padres, we may not be cut out for it. I was just walking around your neighborhood here before the interview and thinking I'm a city boy. And yeah. I really like being able to walk to, a bunch of great local restaurants and coffee shops and bars.
Right.
I mean, this is a great spot you got here, and you can walk to the Beauty Ballroom.
Yeah, I have.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
So we're city folk,
yeah.
You and I.
Yeah.
Did you grow up in Houston?
Well, kind of. I mean, I grew up in the city and the country. We moved around a lot, but there was a lot of country stuff living in a tent in the early times.
I know you were in the circus for a while.
It was kind of, I mean, where are you from? Where were you born? Are you born, bred Austin guy?
I was born in a community south of Houston called Texas City.
Okay, yeah.
And I love to tell people that I'm doubly Texan because I was born in Texas City, Texas.
Yeah.
And then, we got the hell out of there as fast as we could. And I lived in Houston until I was about nine.
In Texas City?
No, or I lived in Houston. We moved to the city because my parents joined a church. And the church was this really progressive sort of hippie commune kind of Christian, born-again Christian kind of deal.
Wow.
It was intense. Yeah. It really was a big influence on the way I, ended up, because that's where I heard my first, folk music, played on acoustic guitars and gospel music and artists and all these kind of bohemian type people who had...
That were looking for a deeper meaning to
wayward
life.
Wayward souls, right. Needing salvation, came to our church, and up to a dozen people who were... that were coming to be part of this ministry lived in our house. So my family had, been going through sort of typical growing pains, and then it became apparent that they needed some kind of intervention. And so they joined this church in the inner city, Houston, and joined this ministry to the inner city in a predominantly Latino part of Houston.
It's like Fourth Ward or something? Or like
Eastwood. Telephone Road.
Right.
The church
in Houston.
Church of the Redeemer.
Okay.
So that was a big, you know, big influence on me growing up.
So were
up.
They, did they work in the church or did they have regular jobs? Or like,
they worked for the church.
Okay, so it was a whole thing. Yeah.
It was absolutely a commune. And it was really, really spiritual, really intense, and a lot of emphasis on, you know, sacrifice to the community and devotion to the
so
word
of the Lord.
So
were you homeschooled at that point?
No, I went to the public school. Okay. The public school right there on Telephone Road, Lantrip. It's the oldest multi-classroom school in Texas or something like that.
Wow.
Yeah, it's, I've been hearing rumors that our church was actually condemned and is either being torn down or is gone now. But I have visited there a few times in the past few years just to kind of reminisce.
The building. Or the people are there at all? Like
the people,
is the ministry
long,
gone?
That whole long thing gone. Dissipated long ago in kind of a cloud of, you know, vague controversies and things. Just
sure.
Nothing too scandalous, but a little bit. And then my family moved on from there because things got dysfunctional. Interestingly enough, one of the people that was one of my childhood friends in that community is David Polkingham.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and his mother was the choir director, and his father was the head honcho. Of the priest of the whole thing.
I saw some pictures of him playing with Robert Plant.
I know, isn't that amazing?
Yeah. Except the pressure would be too much.
Man, the footage...
you know what I mean? Like, wouldn't it would just be like a little too much.
He really rose to the occasion, though. That guy's got chops.
That's good. Well, and also Robert Plant doesn't really expect you to be Jimmy Page. Like, we would think if we were Robert... You know what I mean?
Yeah, but like when he was playing acoustic, though, when Polkingham was playing acoustic intros on some of that stuff. Oh, it's on YouTube.
Okay.
The acoustics,
I saw pictures.
It's so pro and like fluid and like confident. Like, yeah, I'm playing with Robert Plant. Here's some killer flamenco style acoustic for y'all.
Yeah, he's amazing. So you guys got out of there?
Yeah, I lived in Louisiana for a little while.
I knew there was Louisiana thing with you.
We moved to a small town because my dad just took a transfer for the Social Security Administration, and we lived in a small town, and it was. I think just kind of getting out of the city.
What small town? Near what city?
The town is called Tallulah. It's on,
Tallulah.
It's got a bayou running through it, and it's right on the levee of the Mississippi River, and it's about 20 minutes from Vicksburg, Mississippi.
Okay.
And we lived there for 2 years. There's not really that much to say about it, except that it was everything a small town in northeast Louisiana.
And how old were you?
Would be cracked up to be. It was very backward.
Yeah, it must have been weird because you go from this kind of progressive commune thinking guys to like total like...
They thought I was a total freak.
I'm sure they did.
And that was not a good situation for me. And they were about as backward, redneck, you know, stone cold racists as you could imagine. And this town was divided. I went to the mixed high school, but there was a Delta Christian Academy. Was all white, and then there was an all-black school on the other side of the bayou.
Whoa.
and so I just remember, you know, I was in Boy Scouts and stuff like that, but I just remember it being very divisive and hard to find my, you know, place in that town.
How old were you then?
I guess I was, I moved there in sixth grade.
Okay.
And then was there for a couple of years. And I did meet some friends there that I'm still real tight with.
Yeah.
And I just went back to Tallulah a few months ago and played at my friend Mike Foster's Pig Roast. And Ramsey Midwood was on the bill too. And that was kind of fun to go back, you know, after so many years and just see that the town has not changed a bit.
Yeah.
It's exactly the same, except my old high school is boarded up. And so there's one big high school now.
They're just condemning all the buildings that you were once at.
That's right.
What does that do to you psychologically?
It makes me feel like a spring chicken.
Hey, so then you moved here.
Mm-hmm.
And what did your parents do here?
Well,
Social Security Administration.
Yeah, my dad took the gig here once the Louisiana trip was kind of wound up.
Right, and then that's where I heard you when you moved here. I saw this in an interview today. That you got into music, and the scene here was really kicking.
Mm-hmm.
And that was what year?
1980.
Yeah.
I think, yeah, I remember being in Austin for a matter of weeks. I just kind of started the middle, you know, in the middle of a school year. So maybe I was here for a whole semester. I don't know. But anyway, I remember when John Lennon got shot, and that was
okay.
The first semester I was in Austin.
Okay.
In December of 1980.
Yeah. Were you watching the football game?
I was watching the football game. So that is kind of how I mark my, you know, when I arrived in Austin was that semester. I also, as far as being awkward, like, you know, entering the school system in the middle of the semester and being from Louisiana, I remember people making fun of my accent, even though I didn't really have one.
Right.
And I remember everybody was already friends because they had already gone to school for a semester.
And you were just kind
and
of...
And I was just coming in. And then I also was... I was sick. I was allergic to something, and I think it was, my mom said, cedar fever.
Yeah.
And so I was like phlegmatically coughing in the corner of the classroom. No one wanted to, you know, I was just like hacking away for weeks and weeks. So yeah, I was definitely kind of an outsider in my high school years. And then we started a band.
So wait, were you playing guitar before then?
I picked up guitar
okay.
In Louisiana.
So what did you? So you started a band with kids at school because of the music scene that was going on?
Yeah.
In
Louisiana, my mom had a guitar. It was actually a 4-string guitar, and I started playing stuff on that guitar just because it was something to do. And we played at a pep rally one time with, you know, just me and a couple guys that were
okay.
We played Jackson. Because the football team was going to go play Jackson. So
okay.
That was the first time I performed in front of people. It was at a pep rally.
Right.
Then in Austin, being kind of a geek, not really fitting into any of the established cliques there, I was in marching band, but I couldn't really play my instrument very well.
Right.
And I met Brian Sokoff, and we started jamming at his house and learning songs by... The Who and the Kinks and Beatles and stuff. And that was the band. We started a band called The Urge.
Yeah. And you guys were a kid band.
We were a kid band. So that was, you know, that was the beginning of everything, because Austin was...
There was other kids though too. There was like Charlie and Will.
Yeah, it was at a time. It was at a time where somebody who really mentored me early on was Wayne Nagel, and he was booking the Continental Club, and later on maybe the Back Room, but he facilitated some of our first public paying club gigs.
Yeah.
And there was even another band in our high school, and they played there with us. They were called High Exposure, and when we both played the Continental Club on teenage,
Night.
You know, Sunday afternoon, High Exposure
so cool.
had backstage passes and a road manager. It was amazing.
So were you guys doing covers? Were you guys doing like Who and the Kinks kind of mixed in with your own anger?
But also 80s, like new
wave?
Romantics. Let me think, what else? Some of that stuff that was kind of like the power pop of the 80s.
Like the Knack or something.
We played Good Girls Don't. We killed it. It was like that music was very, power pop was very popular. And what was funny, Johnny, was that we were playing stuff that we love, like the Kinks, like Louie Louie, like Shout, from the Animal House soundtrack.
I remember people used to play that stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, and Animal House was real popular. It just came out in the early 80s.
Right.
And so all of a sudden, somebody hired us to play a frat party. And we're teenagers.
Yeah.
Drinking beer.
Yeah.
And rocking out at these fraternity in the basement. On West Campus, one of the first ones we played is right across the street from the hole in the wall, Sigma Tau Gamma. And we were just, I was literally 17.
It's fucking awesome.
It was incredible. It was like...
I can feel that. I went with, Mark Hallman had a band that was a cover band that he would do in between his Dan Fogelberg tours, you know, And he had a gig at one of those, and he took me along when I was like 14, and I got to be at a frat party when I was 14, and it
energy.
I mean, I can smell it. I can smell
crazy
the
energy.
The cheap beer. And yeah, the energy was insane. Everyone's,
hormones.
Yeah. I can just being a few years older. Did you hook it up with any ladies there? Did you rock the house?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I met the first great true love of my life, Jessica Wade. And we had nice romance and lived together for a little while. But that was, that was just a time where everything was really, all heightened and
so were you still
fun and innocent. So innocent. So innocent.
So innocent.
So, such a good, uplifting time.
Yeah.
And we were playing music that we loved. And it just so happened that these fraternity guys loved that music too and wanted to pay us like kings to play it.
Yeah.
Like I'd never, all of a sudden it was like, wow, I may never have to have a job again if I can keep this up.
Right.
So that was kind of, there's something you and I have in common because I've always had a side of my career that involves playing covers.
Yeah.
It's something I've done and I started doing it very innocently.
Yeah.
And then at some point later in my career, I was asked to play in the Argyles, and that was a wedding
right.
band. And so it's just always been there. And this latest band I'm in is also a band that we do all Texas music, and so we're kind of a tribute to all these artists.
That's the Texas Tycoons, and you guys just put out a CD.
It's our second CD.
It's your second CD. But let's talk about this. Was that when you started getting introduced to this music?
Mm-hmm.
Like the music of the Texas Tycoons is like Doug Somm,
yeah,
Bobby Blue Band, Johnny Copeland, Steve Miller even, but Freddie Fender, Delbert McClinton, like the real Texas.
Mm-hmm.
You do Jerry Jeff?
Absolutely. And we do Willis Allen Ramsey. And we do Johnny Guitar Watson. So I just think Texas music is this amazing, all-inclusive genre. You know, it's like a universe of its own. But it is, I think it's a genre. And I think Doug Somm is a great example of how when you use that melting pot and just kind of incorporate everything, it's pretty heady mix.
Yeah.
And so that's what that's our trademark.
I equate, and I don't mean this in any way sacrilegiously, I equate Texas music with those guys like Doug.
Mm-hmm.
And like even guys like Shake Russell, guys that mm-hmm. like when I was a little kid,
Rusty
my
Weir.
Mom was going to go see Rusty Weir. Even more than like a Willie Nelson is almost too worldly and might have spent too much time in Nashville. These guys really do encompass and have, I guess Willie does too, but there's just...
He joined up with
Doug
Somm. The Cosmic Cowboys scene with Steve Fromholtz and Michael Mark Murphy.
And that was already going on.
Already was right. existing in the early 70s and somebody invited Willie to come be part of it.
And so how early in that scene when you were in The Urge, like, mm-hmm. did you go see Doug Somm at that time? Did you go to shows? You were 17?
Well, I can 17? Tell you, my first, the first live concert I ever saw was in Jackson, Mississippi, was the Doobie Brothers. But the first club show I ever saw was at Steamboat, and it was the Austin All-Stars with Stephen Doster and Tommy Taylor and the rest of those, Patterson Barrett. Yeah, those dudes.
I was just talking to someone about Patterson Barrett the other day. I can't remember who it was.
Oh, he can play anything.
Yeah. Is he moved away or he does something
No, he's still
else?
Around. He's still around. He does the Graham Parsons tribute once a year.
Oh, yeah?
At Threadgill's. Ernie Skye, those guys. They were dudes, man. The Sixth Street, there were guys that were like hardworking local musicians playing originals, but also like, playing Sixth Street and getting people to dance.
You got to hear it through the grapevine. I remember that happening a lot when I lived here in the mid 80s.
Sure, playing Creedence and playing Sam and Dave. And so that was, I went to Steamboat when I was 15, ninth grade.
We all did. That sounds like it was so
And then
like,
started playing
with
there.
The days of Lorraine.
Right.
Fabulous Lorraine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Hank Vick.
Yeah. I remember that name, but I just remember Lorraine. Maybe she was always excited to have young boys around.
I remember her, yeah.
I mean, she wasn't creepy, but she always seemed excited to have young boys around.
Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah.
I don't... If
I had a club,
it's funny. I always managed to keep club owners a little bit at arm's length all my life. And now I'm sort of... I'm partnering with them, but... even, I'm real... I've been associated with a hole in the wall for a long time.
Right.
But if, you know, there's a lot of legendary stories about the hole in the wall that somehow I avoided all the nonsense.
Right.
Over the years. A lot of late night stuff. That right. Somehow I was just young enough.
Right.
For them to be protective of and not.
Not have
corrupt.
To be part of it, right?
I don't know how that. I must have done something to warn people that I wasn't going to be the willing participant.
So, how long did the urge go on?
Am I being cryptic enough?
Yeah, you are. You don't do drugs.
The urge. Do you have any?
I remember one night when Skyrocket played. I think that most of us had eaten brownies.
Really?
And you hadn't.
Oh, man.
And I thought that it was our incessant talking that made you go sleep in your truck or something that night. Remember
New
Year's?
Oh, that was New Year's Eve at the camp. Yeah. How did I miss the brownies? Why?
Because I think I literally know I ate like way more than you were supposed to.
Oh, my God. Y'all were talking. Yeah. And I did go find a weird corner of that building to
I think Kyle sleep. Was another guy that wasn't on the brownies, and he was like, oh, God, it was horrible. He was like, I slept in the bathtub.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry. Let's go back. So you said no to drugs, and so the urge. When did you guys? What happened?
So the urge went for a while, and had a lot of different people in and out of the band. So that would have been 1981 or two that we started, and we put out a single with originals, and then that single helped us get a lot of gigs.
Yeah,
and was on the radio. Cracking My Heart, original by Brian Silkoff. And so we started getting some, you know, a little bit of a following and playing places like The Back Room. And that band lasted like, I don't know, 6-7 years. Had a bunch of different drummers and bass players over the years, and then had kind of a classic lineup that ended up going to New York. We played at CBGB's. We did a whole East Coast tour. We played in Louisiana a lot, and Oklahoma and Dallas and stuff. So, I mean, we kind of went, I think, a little bit farther than your typical sort of high school talent show
sure.
band.
Yeah.
We did start out at the Pep Rally, you know.
Yeah.
We started out. this will haunt me forever, Johnny. You know how there's things that just, you know, kind of break your heart. They put us in the yearbook. I was on the yearbook publishing committee, and they had a little section there about the best and worst movies of the year and everything, and it was worst concert, The Urge.
that's just
wrong,
mean.
Right?
That's
how
just
could the
mean.
Publish, how
that's
could
just
the
mean.
How could the lady who, I'm still mad at Mrs. whatever her name is.
She probably is a big fan of the show.
Yeah, she's going to be listening. Paula something.
So I remember I met you, I believe, at some point in the late 80s, I have this distinct memory because I'm almost positive, and I'm sorry to make it like this, but I think I was on acid, and I was at Fitzgerald's in Houston.
That sounds right.
And I might not have even been wearing shoes.
Yeah, and you had the band Panjandrum.
I had the band Panjandrum. But were you in the Urge then?
It was probably a gig
end of
with
the Urge,
and if it wasn't...
Were you in Roman Candles?
It could have been Roman Candles.
That's what I think it was, because I think that I was friends with the guys in Alamo Choir, and you guys were playing with them. Yeah, it was Roman Candles, because you know what? You gave me your cassette that night.
Oh, nice, yeah.
Yeah, I remember that, because I had it after that.
Cool. Well, so how old would you have been? Or when would that have been?
I bet it was 89. I bet I was like 20 or 21. Yeah.
So Roman Candles was...
Yeah.
The band that I had right after The Urge finally broke up. And the reason I left that band, or broke up the band, because I got to a point where I didn't want to write songs and have someone else sing them. And that just became too much for me to process. Like, I just wanted to see if I could do it myself,
right.
front the band. So I had a brief time with the Neptunes, the rockabilly band from D.C. with Pete Gordon that relocated here.
Right.
And it was around the same time that I met Miles Zuniga when I was at UT for a semester. And that semester at UT, I met so many people that are still some of my best friends, like Jeff Groves from the Small Stars, like Mike Kopp, the drummer who played in The Urge and still plays around town with some jazz bands and things. Jeff Hughes from Chaparral was around at that time.
Chaparral.
Yeah. He was Miles's housemate. And just all these people, it was like we were kind of a fraternity hanging out on West Campus, but it was just guys that we were playing music. We started these funny little bands that played like one-off parties. Like we had a band called Opium Fiends, and one night we played, it was a Good Friday, and we played, we like learned and performed Jesus Christ Superstar in one afternoon and drank a lot of Jägermeister.
That is awesome.
Yeah, stuff like that. That was a good time when I met those guys. And I went to St. Edward's, and then I went to UT, and the one semester at UT was when I met all these people that are still like Jeff Johnston, who plays with me in the Texas Tycoons. He was part of that scene when we all met at UT. Kind of around the Consolving dormitory, you know, the cafeteria.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that the Urge kind of was fizzling out, but I was in the Urge when I met those guys, and we were playing these big shows like at the UT Ballroom and stuff, because we had been pretty popular on West Campus, and then they would hire us for these big functions at UT for all the intramural kids. So I believe the first time I met Miles was at the Consolving Kickoff Casual in the ballroom. And then from there, just a lot of things happened. And the reason I brought up Miles was because the Neptunes moved to town, and he basically joined the band, but he had to finish a semester, and I was available to play a tour. And so I toured the East Coast with the Neptunes, and we went to all their sort of like hometown places, and it was awesome.
Yeah.
So that I was, I mean, I really did a lot of sort of shoestring, seat of the pants, Econoline van touring.
Right. What was your role in the Neptunes? Like lead guitar?
Played bass.
Oh, you played bass. Mm-hmm. Right. Okay.
Played bass. I think I went out with them later, just as like the road manager too, like sound guy or whatever.
Yeah.
And then I did some of the same kind of that kind of work. Driving the van and stuff for the Wagoneers.
Oh, yeah, I remember those guys.
And they started around
like a shoestring kind of tie band.
Necktie. Bolo tie band.
Bolo tie, yeah.
They're back. They're playing gigs now. The drummer is in Hay Bale. Tom Lewis, and they all got back together recently. But I was their sound guy. And they recorded an album in Nashville for A&M Records, and I got to go and like see that go down. It was kind of cool. I learned a little bit about publishing and stuff and how the business works, because they were like, they got signed. They were the whole going for that that plan. So that I was, you know, that was, those are some things I did. And then Roman Candles was a band we started.
And how long, that wasn't around too long, was it? A couple years?
It was like 3 years, I think.
3 years.
That was during the whole time when Austin had this incredible indie scene.
The Reavers.
With the Reavers and True Believers. And Wild Seeds. And the bass player for Roman Candles was a sound man for the Reavers, for Zeitgeist.
Uh-huh.
And he lived in this house that is now Spider House.
Oh,
and they called it Big Yellow. And so Wild Seeds and Zeitgeist and some other bands, like I don't know who all, but a bunch of people rehearsed in the basement of the Spider House. I think the Wannabes might have even started out there.
Wow.
Whenever Spider House became a coffee shop, it was really freaky.
Yeah.
I was like, man, I woke up on the couch there, you know?
Yeah.
Right in front of that, where the bar is now.
That's so weird.
Yeah. And then now I hang out there, you know?
Yeah.
Because it's nostalgic.
Yeah.
And it was such a great time. It was the bass player, and then for my band, and then the bass player for the Wild Seeds, Paul Swift, and a guy who sold weed. And that was the three guys in that house.
That was always an important part of like the youth culture in Austin, was there had to be like a weed guy among you.
They had their air conditioner somehow, they had like bypassed the meter, and so it was always like freezing cold in there. The giant window unit was just like always kicking, and that place, that was a party house. And so that was when I met a lot of those musicians, like the you know, the guys that kind of started that scene. I'll keep talking.
Oh no no no! Okay. I was gonna try and find this. There was a scene that me and Ben always talk about, and it was, I guess, when the Duck Hills were coming up, and when I when the Duck Hills were coming up, and when I moved here the second time after Panjandrum.
Mm-hmm.
Just like that whole West Campus area, like there were a couple of like co-op houses,
yeah,
that had amazing parties.
Well, I can, you know, backtrack a little bit. One of the very first gigs that my band, The Urge, had was at a co-op.
Yeah, and little lower rent than the frats.
Yeah, but the Skunks played.
Yeah.
at that party, or one of the ones they had, and Joe Ely was there jamming with people. And there was, the Big Boys were back in that scene. It was in, just to backtrack a little bit, just in case anybody's like keeping score.
Yeah.
And you asked about Margaret Moser and the whole Hall of Fame thing. When I was in high school and I was in the band The Urge, I was approached by the you know, the guidance counselor or some kind of honors program, and they presented the opportunity to me to be an intern at a local business, and I could pick. So the first local business that I picked was this guy who made guitars for Stephen Doster and Joe Ely and Joe King Carrasco, named Newman Jones. And I loved these guitars, and they were on the album covers of all these guys that I worshipped. And so I started working for him, sanding these guitar bodies that he
had cool cut as shit. Out of. Why did you even leave that out of the story? That's fucking cool.
Well, there's a, you know, going in a lot of different tangents, but I only did that for a couple of weeks, and I would go there a couple times a week. But those guys were the biggest bunch of just like miscreants. They were not just smoking weed, they were giving each other those like hippie power hits, you know, where you kind of blow smoke in the other guy's mouth. I was like 15 years old, and these guys were
giving. Sounds bordering on the little gay stuff there.
It was weird. I mean, it's a little too much, you know. It was definitely homoerotic, but also just decadent.
Yeah.
I mean, Newman Jones toured with the Rolling Stones. He makes guitars for Keith Richards, and I think he's in jail or dead now. I'm not sure. Someone can verify that. But
tweet at me.
Let's do it. And so the thing is, I was too young for that scene.
Yeah.
And I remember they had a G.I. Joe doll in there that they had glued like a big black phallus on and burned with cigarettes and given it tattoos. Like, I was just too young. All this stuff was just like blowing my mind
freaky,
too much.
A little freaky.
So I went back to the school and said, I should probably change. Yeah. And so the my second choice was the Austin Chronicle.
Okay, so that's
at
how
the
you
tender age of 15, I was working for Margaret Moser in her office, and she had people like Dino Lee and Joe King Carrasco and Alejandro and, you know, the Big Boys coming by. And so that was where I met everybody that is people that are still real important in the scene, like Jay Trachtenberg and Louis Black and Nick Barbaro and Margaret. It all started when they've known me since I was just like totally wet behind the ears, and I was like a mascot. I was the first intern. They've had hundreds since then. So that was kind of where my sort of, you know, career in Austin music as a person who's kind of, you know, been able to find a path to success.
Right.
Kind of start out as a kid, just eager to learn and be involved.
Yeah.
And the Chronicle was great. I did some writing for them. Matter of fact, there was a book they published recently, and out of all the people who've ever written for the Chronicle, one of my articles was in the book.
Oh, that's awesome.
It's a review of Willie Nelson at the Capitol, and I was so surprised when it came
out. How old were you when you were at the review?
That, to me, is a bigger honor than the Hall of Fame, actually, but they both are great honors.
They're both good.
That was a little later. I wrote that, yeah, when I was just out of college, I think.
Okay. So back, let's go back then to the future.
Mm-hmm. Back to the future, sure.
And what we're talking is the late 80s, early 90s. At mm-hmm. post-Roman Candles, what was the move that you made then? What was your next? That's when you joined the Argyles? You're like, hey, I want to make a little bread?
No. A lot happened. We don't want to forget Beaver Nelson.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And that was probably one of the major sort of turning point kind of things, because Beaver Nelson got signed. And I was a doorman at the Electric Lounge when they opened around 90, I think.
Oh, yeah. Beaver got signed.
And Beaver got signed by
RCA.
There was like
thing.
A little bidding thing going on for Beaver, and he was talking to Columbia and Sony and stuff. And then he went with this label that is owned by James Cameron, the Titanic.
Yeah, of Titanic fame.
Guy. And it was funny because...
who else was on
this
his
was
label?
This would have been pre-Titanic, right? But he had done Terminator. That was what was exciting. You know, it was like, wow.
And Terminator
he wants,
2.
And he wants to get into this stuff, you know, publishing. Yeah. And he had signed Billy Idol and everything. And so Beaver...
This is mid-90s? We say in 94, 95?
No. 90. 91.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, yeah, because that's when I first moved here, and there was like an excitement around mm-hmm. Beaver.
This was the time... All right, so... to take a snapshot, because we skipped around a lot.
What about to take a Beaver shot?
We're going to take a Beaver shot right now. I can count on you to take it there.
Okay, yeah.
Beaver, he had been courted by these companies and stuff, but he had had several different people come through his band, all, and he produced a lot of demos and things. But then when these guys signed him, they said, kid, you're great, but you need to put together a like more rock and roll young, you know, band that is like stage ready and all this. So you know, the whole thing,
they don't still do that anymore unless
like
you're trying
that.
To be One Direction.
It was like
yeah
that.
Yeah, no, I remember.
And so that Beaver kind of recruited me. I remember playing pool with him at the Hole in the Wall and having him ask, you know, if I wanted to try out for the band. And then we real soon after that we had a South by showcase, and then, you know,
it was an important one.
Yeah,
with a lot of people were there.
Mm-hmm. At the Hole in the Wall. And then, yeah, and then they took us to California. And when we were in LA, they introduced us to some musicians. And one of them was Tony Scalzo from Orange County, who had been in all these
punk bands,
these post-punk bands,
just
Orange County. Post-punk bands like the Goods and the he's gonna kill me if I can't remember that one. That's it's not Social Distortion, but it's like one of those kind of
not Agent Orange, but one of those bands. Like a he was in a seminal punk rock band.
Yeah, okay. He was.
Yeah,
and so
he was on the show. I'll go back and listen to it.
Yeah, he mentions it in there. I'm just having a brain fart, but so so Tony came from that scene. And then there was a guy named Jamie Riedling, and both those guys relocated to Austin to join Beaver's band to make an album for Lightstorm Records. And so,
going into it, Lightstorm Records doesn't sound powerful.
It doesn't.
It
looking back,
terrible.
Does it? Should have gone with Sony, right? So,
So they moved here,
and this was in the heyday of the Austin Rehearsal Complex.
Oh, yeah.
And so the snapshot of my life was that I was living with this girl who was, you know, not a girlfriend, but she just had a room for rent in a condo in West Austin for $75 a month. And she was like a Sixth Street princess, you know, just nightlife, you know, social butterfly. And it was so funny. She was a total trip, and she would do aerobics in front of a full-length
mirror
and play this mixtape that started off with girls, girls, girls.
Yeah.
And I'd hear that, you know, every day. Yeah. And she'd be out there
aerobicizing.
Yeah, like full on, like she was nuts. And I would get on my bike and I would ride across the town lake, across that Mopac Bridge, down Congress to the ARC. Yeah. And we were in pre-production every day.
All your stuff was there, so you didn't have to take
the car. We had a lockout room and we'd see the Archangels and we'd see Malford and we'd run into, you know, the guys from Pariah.
Yeah.
The whole scene. The Ark was awesome.
Yeah.
And so we were part of that, you know, seed was in there. And so we were just part of this scene at the Ark and we had a lockout and we wrote a bunch of songs together. So I was going to have a bunch of co-writes on this album. Then we were playing kind of like a residency at the Electric Lounge to get ready.
Right.
And so we had this kind of cool Tuesday night thing going on. And then we went to Memphis in 1994 and recorded at Ardent Studios where the ZZ Top recorded Eliminator and where the Replacements recorded and where Big Star recorded.
Yeah, that's what I was saying.
So it was, we were just like, that would be the one time when
you introduced me to Jody Stevens.
I'm sure I did.
You did at his table at the conference at South by Southwest many, many years ago.
You I was could like, not meet a nicer guy.
Yeah.
He would come in and jam with us.
Yeah, go ahead, sorry.
He would come in and listen to the mixes and all that.
Yeah.
The producer who came to Austin was a guy named Joe Blaney, and he had recently mixed Combat Rock for The Clash and done a bunch of work with Prince. He had a bunch of great stories. He recorded and mixed Talk Is Cheap by Keith Richards.
Wow.
So he had a great resume. But, you know, the Memphis experience was a total trip, but the band kind of melted down. We were not a real band.
Who were the other guys? Scalzo?
Yeah, I forgot that Jamie from California didn't work out.
Didn't work out.
He moved back, and so we got Joey Sheffield.
Oh, yeah.
Because their band with Miles and Jeff Groves and Cole Hanson
had recently broken up. Right.
So they had just done their major label kind of effort. Big Car. Yeah.
Right.
So Big Car had broken up, so Joey was free. And then he kind of, I think Joey was instrumental in recruiting. I forget exactly how it all went down, actually.
Right.
Somebody needs to remind me if it's important. That we ended up being a band made up of me and Beaver and Tony and Joey Sheffield. And we went to Memphis. And then the band broke up kind of while we're recording. We sort of went on for a little while after that. But then the record just never came out.
Never came out. Yeah, I remember that. That happened a lot to him because I remember he had a development deal for a while. Yeah, and then he had this other thing.
It just felt like a tax write-off. Like it wasn't a priority. Those guys were dragging their feet and just weren't, like it wasn't important to them to get the record out. It was more important just to have a project to blow a bunch of money on.
Right.
We went to Sony in Santa Monica and mixed it. And then,
so then that fizzled out. And then what did you do? Is that when you started Super Ego?
That was, it was on the heel. I was working the door at the Electric Lounge. We came back from Memphis, played a few more shows. I think I eventually, left the Beaver Nelson Project after we had a couple more drummers and bass players and stuff. Kevin Carroll and the Slee Stacks guys were a band for a while.
Yeah.
And then, if I'm misremembering any of this and any of these guys are listening, I apologize. It's just, it was a while ago.
Well, everybody knows that.
Everybody knows. Yeah. But so, the chronology.
I mean, at this point, it's almost 20 years ago.
It's so,
you know what I mean?
So fucking.
I mean,
long
that's.
Ago.
What, I mean, like Mr. Rockababy broke up 19 years ago,
and it's not even important. Ago. And I don't know why anybody would care. And why the hell am I even sitting here?
So, it's called "How Did I Get Here?" Not "Why Am I Here?"
Yeah. So then, this is almost like a time capsule for any you know archaeologists in the future. Yeah. I'm just trying.
But
that's why I want to try to set the record straight.
Because, you know, I mean, to me, I'll tell you, like, I'd see you a little bit, and then I wouldn't see you, and then I'd see you again. I didn't know what was going on.
Yeah. So that's what went on. And then, you know, my memory after that is very clear. I was working in Electric Lounge, and then I think the club probably
closed. Yeah.
And what the hell are we going to do next? The Sunday night at the Hole in the Wall started. And now the bartender and bass player from the Electric Lounge, John Nodal, and I were sitting around at Deep Eddy, just enjoying like a total slacker summer.
Yeah.
And
I love slacker summer.
Yeah. And then in September of 94, we did our first free-for-all. That was a crazy weekend because my...
What year?
It's 94.
Wow. Yeah.
See, the Beaver Nelson band was in Memphis in April of 94 when Kurt Cobain killed himself, and that was like a I think a bad omen.
I got married that weekend.
Interesting. Wow.
Bad omen as well.
Yeah. Man, we heard some great stories at that studio, some ZZ Top stuff that'll blow your mind. I'll tell you off mic.
Off record. Yeah. Okay.
So we started the thing at the Hole in the Wall, right. And the rest I think maybe is a little more well known, but it just it was that's a concept we had. What are we going to do next? Yeah. We're just sitting around at the pool. And then we, you know, there was a Sunday night available. And then we did one, and I think Beaver came, and I think Miles came, and I think Kevin Carroll from the Slee Stacks, and who'd been playing with Beaver. I think we just had a jam on a Sunday night in September of 1994. And then they said, you want to come back next week? And then it did turn into this weekly variety show, and we started pulling in a lot of new bands that were wanting to be part of this
Electric Lounge guys, because I remember mm-hmm. I remember seeing 16 Deluxe there maybe at the first
Deluxe.
One or one of the
absolutely.
First ones I went to.
That would have been in the first year, and the Damnations
and
the Gourds, and later
Magneto
on
Magneto USA
which
later became Fastball.
Mm-hmm. So it just became a little local focal point. And also
But it also became a thing like the Sunday night of South by Southwest. It was a thing, and you used to do themes then, I remember, too. Like, I remember...
I became associated with Hoot Nights, and I didn't invent them. I want to give credit to Michael
Hoot
Hall.
Hoot Nights are good.
Yeah, Michael Hall and Steve Chaney and those guys that were putting together stuff at the Cannibal Club.
Right.
But, you know, we kind of ran with the ball on that, and so the Sunday night of South by... traditionally became a big deal. We did the Last Waltz for the first time here, and I think it was probably 96 or 7.
Yeah.
And that was probably the biggest night the Hole in the Wall ever had up to that point. And Ivan Neville sat in with us, and Dennis Quaid was in the audience, and it was just such a trip.
I met Sandra Bullock at Sunday night at the Hole in the Wall.
I believe you.
I did.
I met Quentin Tarantino there.
Wasn't like Don Henley there, one of them?
That was not free for all. That was early on, and like probably in the late 80s when Mojo Nixon was playing, and Don Henley showed up and sang Don Henley Must Die with Mojo Nixon. Right. So that was
That's pretty cool.
So I'd been playing the Hole in the Wall with The Urge and Roman Candles for years. As a matter of fact, I turned of age twice at the Hole in the Wall after having been drinking there.
Oh, right, because you were 19.
I was 19, and there was the grandfather clause, and there was 21, and I don't know. So anyway, it was funny, because like, I'd been playing there and drinking forever, and then, oh, it's my birthday, I'm 21.
So out of that kind of, out of doing that, is that kind of, was the Texas Tycoons just kind of born out of maybe some guys there playing together?
All right, so what...
Did I jump too far?
It's okay. We were the house band, and we were the Super Ego All-Stars.
Right.
And that was like John from Flying Saucers and, you know, for a little while, the drummer from 16 Deluxe. And
what, Jeff? No, that was the guy from...
And then Andrew.
Andrew.
Andrew Duplantis.
Yeah. Who was Andrew was in the band.
Playing in that something Thieves, Radio Thieves at the time, and then he joined Super Ego. So we had a lot of... You know, we had a few people come in. And
Kevin
many,
of many last
Lance,
names.
He joined, and then you know, so we were the house band. We were like the Hole in the Wall Sunday night house band, and we would provide the back line.
Yeah,
and
did.
Then bands would just come and jam, and we would have three or four bands a night, sometimes five.
Yeah.
So that's great. How, so Super Ego kind of evolved out of that, and we ended up recording some CDs.
Yeah.
And then somewhere along the line, I think that was all going pretty good, and then Hole in the Wall closed for a year.
Yeah.
And then we tried to come back and do that, can continue that, and it kind of petered out. And
it's tough to recreate magic.
Yeah,
you can't really
do it.
It
had its heyday.
It had its time.
90s.
Yeah.
It was such a...
Yeah.
It had its own momentum, and there was really no...
It was like those softball games. You remember?
that was around the same time.
Yeah, like if they all of a sudden like, hey, let's try and do the softball, like, no one would go.
Yeah.
Langer wouldn't even go, or Anar.
That's right, but it was... Those were great times. And so we did some recording. We had a bunch of great hoot nights. We had a Willie night. We had a disco with the Bee Gees and stuff.
Yeah.
Remember? We tricked Spencer into playing the Bee Gees hoot night. That was pretty funny.
I had to prompt him.
Were you there?
I had to prompt him. Yeah. I had to tell him the words. It's like, how do you
not?
These fed you.
Yeah.
Like, they didn't feed me.
But like,
not another words. Yeah.
Spoon played.
Spoon.
Like one of their first shows there.
That's right. That's another big one. When I remember.
When the girl Andy was on bass.
Yes. And when Britt was playing
acoustic
through the amp. Yeah.
I loved Spoon when they
I remember that.
Acoustic.
Yeah. I saw them at those Sunday.
Texture.
Yeah, shit, man.
And the Scabs played one of their first shows. They just showed up in their suits. They were not on the bill. And they had just put the band together, and it was Slowpoke.
Are you friends with Bob Stark?
Yeah, I'm friends with Bob. I am, in passing.
Yeah, I think that's how it works. I'm not going to lie to you. He sent me a text that said, Merry Christmas, Johnny. I hope you're having a good one.
Nice.
I swear. I thought that was really weird. I didn't know what to say, so I wrote him back, and I said, you too, Bob.
I admire him greatly. And
me too.
He's a very focused artist.
Out of all that stuff, the tycoons, because it's some of the guys kind of started spilling over. There's some guys, some all-stars in here.
Yeah. The tycoons is actually...
How did you just wake up one day and you're like, okay,
yeah.
I'm going to make this set list, and these are the parameters that I'm going to work in, right? There's parameters. You're not going to do a...
I started playing, gigs as just a solo artist. And put out a couple of CDs,
right.
Under my name,
right.
Doing originals. But ever since I was in high school, playing frat parties, and then I was in the Argyles for 5-6 years playing weddings, I've always done covers. And the whole time I've been doing that, there's been people out there who've helped facilitate gigs and done some PR work and booked the bands I was in and helped us... get the product out there. And one of those guys is Freddie Warner, and he booked The Urge, Roman Candles, Neptunes. He goes way back as a kind of promoter, freelance promoter, but he's also a great singer, and he's always wanted to do a band in order to play at some of these kind of high roller functions that he books as a guy who works around the Capitol as a lobbyist and working for companies
right.
in state government and working, he's worked for he's worked for politicians at the state level on both sides of the aisle
right.
as a freelance promoter for years and years. That's his career, but he loves music, and he puts together these shows, and he books ZZ Top and Dale Watson and stuff, and puts together production and the logistics of these parties where these politicians and their staffs are kind of celebrating the end of the legislative session and stuff like that. So we put a band together to back up Freddie.
Okay.
Right?
And he's going to play all Texas.
And he had a set list that wasn't all Texas.
Okay.
And we played a couple of parties just kind of doing the party band
right.
repertoire. Right. Proud Mary and Mustang Sally and stuff.
Right.
But then I was just driving home from a gig in Galveston, and I had been doing sound for Joe Ely, and I was just listening to my, just a playlist of stuff that I wanted to play, and so much of it was Texas. And I got to say, I was influenced by bands like yours, like Skyrocket, that have done well to have a theme and
focus.
try to work within these boundaries so that people can relate to the the theme of the band.
Yeah.
So what's our theme going to be?
Yeah.
Boom. And
easy.
And yeah, it was,
no one else is doing it.
It was a no-brainer. So we immediately put together, you know, three sets of Texas music, and then we were off to the races. So that's how Texas Tycoon started. It's not totally contrived, but it was, you know, an inspiration.
You have to have a plan.
Just something, you know, how can we find our niche, you know, among all the bands that are out there doing these, you know, private parties and functions and weddings and fundraisers and things like that. Because I've been in that market forever, and it's good to have something to kind of hang your hat on.
Yeah.
So that's our concept. And
so how long has it been going?
I think maybe 6 years now. First couple of gigs were not really under the name Texas Tycoons, and I think it was 4 or 5 years ago that we officially started billing it that way.
Corey Glazer, didn't he play some
Goofy Goos? Yeah, he's played a few shows with us, yeah.
And you got Scalzo in the band?
Scalzo's in the band now. Matt Hubbard is in the band occasionally. He started out. He's on the first CD.
Right.
And helped us record it. Landis and Kevin Lance play with Paula Nelson. And Freddie's the singer. And Steven Johnson is our real secret weapon saxophone player. And Jeff Johnston is bass player. He's from Little Captain Travis.
Yeah. He's fabulous.
Yeah, so there's a lot of talented guys, and everybody really enjoys the material. And
so there's enough material. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Obviously, you got to throw in some Freddie Fender hits. You got to have some hits.
Oh, no,
but you can kind of mess around and kind of throw in a Jerry. Do you Jerry Jeff?
We play Northeast Texas Women, which is a Willis Allen Ramsey song. We also play London Homesick Blues, which is from Jerry Jeff's classic album.
Right.
Viva Terlingua.
Yeah.
But
is that the one where they're all wasted?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's...
Corey told me about that album. I don't think I've heard it. I gotta hear it, though.
Viva Terlingua?
Yeah.
It's amazing. Yeah.
Maybe I have, growing up or something.
What
about Shake Russell? Sorry, my dentist.
We'll look into it. The latest song that I'm excited about is Michael Martin Murphy's Cosmic Cowboy. And I remember it from when I was a kid. And it was one of the first songs I learned to play on guitar. And it's like all of a sudden it's coming back to me, and I just realized I already know a whole bunch of the lyrics.
Yeah.
So we've been playing a happy hour at the Hole in the Wall. And I've been kind of busting out some new songs that I want us to try.
Yeah.
And so that one's going to come out soon.
So when is the Hole in the Wall weekly show?
We are doing Wednesdays.
Okay.
Should be at least through January.
At what time?
At 7 o'clock.
Okay. 7 to like 9?
Yeah.
10?
It's 7 9. To 9. It's free. And you got to come because the Hole in the Wall has a new kitchen. And Paul Key from Uchiko is now the cook at the Hole in the Wall. And there's an amazing
menu. Are you shitting
menu.
Me? Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah. It's pretty phenomenal, actually.
Wow.
So it's kind of a dinner show, and
Wednesday nights
that food is off the hook.
That's a good night. There's not a lot going on every Wednesday.
I sure do enjoy it. I'm you know, get back into having a weekly gig, which is something I've always really enjoyed.
Like, as we get older, the hour is always so good. Are you like, is that like a selling point for you? Because it is for me. Like Skyrocket, like we were like, oh, I don't know, it's just, you know, go and play out at this place, Steiner Ranch, but we're done by 10. And it's just like, wow.
That's nice, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because the Rock and Roll Free-for-All used to go till 2 and sometimes later. Yeah. And we were the headliner, which meant that sometimes we didn't go on till 1:30. And we'd wait around all night while all the bands played on our gear. And then we was like our turn to play our four songs.
Yeah.
So this is different. We get to play for a couple hours.
Yeah.
And then we get to go eat at the Eastside King at the Hole in the Wall. So,
yeah.
Yeah, that's...
Do you play in the front or you play in the back room?
Well, we play on that main stage on the street. Not the back
Not that
area.
Back stage. I feel weird about that stage.
No, it's great.
I feel...
It's great because they, you know, the Hole in the Wall can hold a lot more people than it used to. And so that stage is like a showcase for the big weekend draws. And I am responsible for that sound system. And, you know, it's definitely a professional setup.
Yeah.
At the Hole in the Wall now. And I've got PAs in a bunch of clubs in town now. So that's kind of what I do for a living.
Yeah.
And, you know, Hole in the Wall, I think, is a great place to showcase, you know, excellent live rock and roll.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't know if you remember this, but, like, I know that you do. Mm-hmm. I know you do because I remember that the guy that was Lars Ulrich's partner at our label had a, I can't remember if it was a Super Ego pick or a Free For All pick.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I remember he gave... I said, I need a pick. Before I went on stage one time, he handed me a pick. And I was like,
Free For All.
Is this a fucking joke? What are you making fun of me? Because I was like in Seattle or something. And I was like,
I wonder why I had that.
How do you have this guy's pick? No, crazy. I remember they loved you. They loved the concept. And they, when we were making our record here with Mike McCarthy, our A&R guy was here. And Sunday night, that's what we do is go down there. And we played once.
Well, do you remember when Mike McCarthy was, you know, producing the Rock and Roll Free For All compilation? And
that's when I met him. The time and it was in the basement of that place.
That's also around the time. That's around the time he met Spoon and met
Britt,
met Fastball and
Trail of Dead.
He was new in town when he got to town, and when he got here, that was one of the first things that, you know, he came in the Electric Lounge, met me at the door. I said, you got to check out this thing we're doing on Sunday nights. And then,
then he made that record.
All of a sudden, we made that El Flaco. Compilation.
That was the other band we're leaving out.
El Flaco was, they were destined for greatness
on
that label.
Any more solo albums on the horizon?
Well, what I'm doing now is I'm writing songs for the Texas Tycoons. So we are a cover band. But on the latest CD, I wrote a song that I hope to be my theme song. It's called Lone Star Soul.
I'm going to play that at the end of the show.
It's semi-autobiographical. And
you wrote it with Jason Blum?
Yeah, I did.
Love that guy.
I wrote it in Marfa with Jason Blum. And I had an idea that I needed to write a song that the Texas Tycoons could record that would be kind of an anthemic Texas, you know, classic, for me to have like a theme song.
Your song.
My jam.
Yeah, that's your jam.
And so I guess I'm going to continue to write for the Tycoons. And I play my originals on Wednesdays as well.
What about ever getting together with, they're fading fast, but like, you know, get together with maybe Michael Martin Murphy.
Mm-hmm.
Write a song.
Why not?
For the Texas Tycoons.
Absolutely.
Wouldn't that be cool? One of those guys.
That
one of
the guys who songs. That would be such an honor.
But there's so many of them gone now, like Freddie Fender, Doug Somm, Rusty Weir, Stephen Frommholtz. Frommholtz is still around. I'm so sorry.
It's okay. Who else? There's guys that
keep
still...
on thinking Shake Russell, but it's because I went to the dentist the other day, and I told my dentist about the podcast, like, I guess, like, I don't know, a year ago or something. Mm-hmm. And he's super into music. He plays Texas music when you go in there. It's not Shane. It's this other dude. Dr. Lindsay's been my guy for a long time. So he was literally working on me and goes, oh, I thought of someone for your show. And I was like, who? He was like, Shake Russell.
Oh, that would be cool.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and the Cosmic Cowboy scene is something that's real near and dear to my heart.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of dudes that are still around from the 60s soul scene, like the Houston Cats, like Archie Bell,
And the Drells,
and Roy Head, I'm pretty sure Bobby Blue Bland is still out there playing.
Yeah,
so there's some cats that are still.
That's a good
still. Little Joe Washington,
Little Joe, I just saw
gigs.
Him.
Barbara Lynn still does gigs, and so that, you know, side of the more R&B side of the Texas scene is something that we really try to emphasize, and there's still a lot of those people still out there, like, working.
Yeah, Joe played a happy hour at the Continental Club before Skyrocket Show, and I saw him, and I tried to talk to him about doing a podcast, but he did not understand the concept.
Yeah, for those of you near a computer, look up Little Joe Washington sitting in with Texas Tycoons.
Oh,
it's
yeah?
It's incredible.
I'll totally look that up.
It was at the
He was playing with his feet. And everything. I mean, I'd never seen anything like it. And he had a Casio. It was fucking nuts.
He's phenomenal.
Man.
He's phenomenal. He can play.
He can play. I mean, yeah.
He was There's whipping like it out.
That's better than any wheedly dude from the 80s.
It was great because he was in the audience and we just started playing a song that we do. And when he heard us start to play just a little bit, which is this old Roscoe Carter song that Delbert McClinton and Jimmy Vaughn, everybody's covered it.
Yeah, yeah.
Teeny Weeny Bit of Your Love, right?
Yeah.
We started playing that and he just made a beeline for the stage and grabbed the first guitar he saw, start playing. He wasn't like summoned onto the stage.
No. That was a straight up bum rush.
That jam got him up on stage.
Yeah.
And then after the set, somebody tells me he played drums on the track.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
He seems like a guy that could play. I tried to be like, I have this show where I interview musicians, and he just was like, I don't have a cell phone. I got to get on my, literally, this is what he said. I have to get on my bicycle, go home and smoke my medicine.
Oh, wow.
Because if I don't, I'm going to be in a bad mood pretty soon.
So that's the kind of guy who's, legacy that we're trying to honor. And
I love that.
And keep moving forward and just be like, yeah, it's an honor to be on stage with him and also to play that music that we just appreciate so much.
So you guys go down there and play at the Big Top mm-hmm. in Houston? Is that a regular thing? Or?
Well, like we'll pick up a party or something in Houston, and then if it works out, we'll play like the night before, at the Continental or a Big Top or Natachi's, which is that whole strip in Houston that Pete Gordon has developed a whole city block.
Yeah, it's great on Main Street there.
So sometimes we play Natachi's during dinner and then go down to the Big Top and finish out the night.
That's a good time.
It's a great time, yeah.
Well, everyone, so is there a Texas Tycoons website?
MinorProductions.com.
MinorProductions.com.
Mm-hmm. And Minor Productions can also supply, any...
Any of your sound needs?
PA system needs and,
A good sound man, good PA, great musician.
We try.
Yeah.
Do what we can.
You got another guy?
I've got a crew of guys who are working in these clubs.
Because I always say we about the podcast, but it's just me.
There's a mouse in my pocket and he's still got good ears.
Yeah.
He's still got his high end.
That's good.
So people are probably going to see me around mostly when their band is playing at one of these clubs.
Yeah. Or they'll go see the Texas Tycoon on
Wednesday. On a Wednesday. We play Guero's once a month is a fun scene.
Oh yeah. Outside at Guero's.
There's no gig in town like that. It's a beautiful courtyard. And
it's very Austin too.
We really look forward to that one.
Yeah. Yeah.
So hopefully people will come by. And get into the scene and make requests and give us some good suggestions on your favorite Texas music.
There you go, Dr. Lindsay. Go out and request your Sheik Russell from the Texas Tycoons.
Man, I'm trying to think of a Sheik Russell song. But
he had a hit. You've got a lover, but it's not me. And he can't love you like I can.
Come sing it with us.
Okay. You got it.
It's on.
I'll put that on the list.
I like that idea a lot.
Paul, is there anything I'm missing?
No. I think that we've covered a lot of ground.
Thanks for doing this. I'm glad that we got to sit down.
It needed to happen. I'm glad it did.
It's a classic dude, a Hall of Fame. And now you get an understanding of why some music is coming up in the background right now. Yeah, it's a good jam.
Screw me.
Thanks for coming.
Thank you. Come on.
Well, she strolled on up to me. Yeah. Paul Miner. It's Texas Tycoons, man. Those guys are awesome. Be sure you go check out Paul. Go check out the Texas Tycoons. Follow him on Facebook and do that stuff. And be sure you hire Miner Productions for your production needs. They run sound. They have a lot of sound systems everywhere. Even Hotel Vegas, where I've played a lot. So anyway, thank you so much to Paul for coming by, taking the time, talking, my longtime friend. And thank you, my longtime friends, for listening. And remember when you're on iTunes to subscribe to this podcast and also to write a little comment down there and rate it. Give it some stars.
Let us know how we're doing. Let us get some ratings. And like us on Facebook. Follow me on Twitter. I'm also on Instagram, at Johnny Gowdy. It's like you get the full package. Get, you know, you want me in your life? There you go. I'm there. I'll be there with my life infringing into yours. By the way, I'm still in Miami. Oh, my God. Okay, so this is the original song that Paul and my friend Jason Blum, who was on the show some months back when he moved here from New York, they wrote this song together for the Texas Tycoons, and they're hoping this is going to be a classic. Here you go. A little more Texas Tycoons. Let's get down.
Texas.